irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Power of Love Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Power of Love, sponsored by the D.D. Jackson Foundation. We are here to provide hope, resources, and a community so no one feels alone in their grief. I am TJ Jackson, and with me I have both of my brothers, Taj and Tara. How are you, fellas?
What's going on?
What's up?
How you guys doing? I feel good today.
Yeah?
Yeah, I feel good.
That's good.
Yeah. How you guys doing? You good?
Doing well.
Good, good.
Doing well.
We are live on the Power of Love show, so if you're listening to us, thank you for joining us. Later on in the show, we're going to open up Twitter, where if you want to make a comment, ask a question, any type of commentary, please feel free to do so by tweeting us at DDJ Foundation. Again, it's the letters DDJ, the word foundation. We are not licensed therapists. We're just ordinary people who've experienced loss in our lives. We've been impacted by it, and we've learned from it. And we want to share our opinions in an attempt to help you overcome whatever it is you're going through. Saying that, if you need professional help, we urge you to seek it and to find it. Do not just rely on us. So there was an intro, disclaimer, a method for our listeners to get in touch with us. I think I nailed it all. Let's go into the next part of this show and talk about how your weeks were. How was it?
Weeks were good.
Anything?
Wait. There's a lot.
Yeah, we had birthdays.
This is the birthday week.
The
it
birthday
starts
week.
With Prince.
Yes.
Prince is on the 13th.
Yep.
Then you got Adrian on the 17th.
Yep.
Then you got Bryce on the 20th, which was yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
And then today.
It's BG. It's
BG's birthday,
yeah.
The 21st.
So happy birthday to all the young Jackson clans. The Jacksons, part of the clan, of course.
Yeah.
We love each and every one of you and hope this year will bring nothing but love, prosperity, and intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Keep learning, kids.
Yes.
All right. So besides the birthdays, anything else?
Yeah, there's
exciting?
Also Charles Barkley.
What?
He has a birthday. I think his is on the 17th or the 20th.
Is
Michael
it?
Jordan.
Oh, that's right.
Rihanna.
Okay.
They're all
Dang,
in there, too.
A lot of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. And then there was All-Star Game, which I missed. But I heard it was great. Different format.
I missed it as well. And we missed it because we played in a basketball game, which was a lot of
fun.
Yeah,
that's why we weren't there.
Which is another thing. I encourage all of you to stay active, especially as you're getting older and your responsibilities are growing. You have to stay active and take mm-hmm. care of your health.
Yeah, so we had a basketball game.
Yes.
It was you, me, Royal, and a couple friends.
Show?
Right? Yeah, he played well.
Yeah, he played really well.
Played really well.
And a couple friends.
It's that youth.
But I think the big news of the week outside of us is Black Panther.
The
film Black Panther. And I like Marvel. I'm not a crazy Marvel head. I'm not a crazy superhero head. But I loved Black Panther, and it's probably the first Marvel movie that I will be seeing twice in a theater.
You didn't see it already twice?
No, I haven't seen it yet. I got, but I'm gonna try to see it this weekend in 3D this time. Mm-hmm. I saw it in regular 2D, but something about that movie seems like it's worth watching in 3D. The world they built.
Yeah, you saw it in 3D, right?
Yes,
Taj?
I did. It was great in 3D.
So
it was great.
It was good, right, Taj?
Oh yeah. I'm happy I saw it again in 3D.
Yeah, that's what I'm right behind you, my brother. So,
I know.
That movie is just very empowering. So if you haven't seen it, make sure you go check it out. It's just, you know, and like I said in actually one of my Instagram stories, as a young Black African American, it was really cool and empowering, and they calling it a movement to see, you know, pretty much an all Black cast. Lift this movie up. Mm-hmm. So it was really beautiful to see and really empowering, and I'm happy it's doing the success it's doing.
Yeah, it shadows it shatters the myth too that there's an old myth in Hollywood that a Black cast doesn't bring in money.
Yeah.
And that's was one of the reasons why there weren't more people of color in movies, because they said people don't go out to see them, and this movie just shattered that for that. So
I thought it was really well done. I enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. I thought
it
was fantastic.
Yeah, it broke records. So,
anyway, you guys, today we have an amazing show. I'm excited. We don't have the guest here in studio with us, but she's on the phone. Today we have Dr. Sandra Gilbert, who is a renowned feminist. She's a literary critic. She's an award-winning author and poet. And she's a retired professor at UC Davis. And she's here to discuss many of her books, but the most recent, I believe, is Death's Door, Modern Dying and the Way We Grieve. And I first of all, I just love that title, because as you know, us three always talk about on the show, death is kind of has that negative, you know, it's like something you don't talk about. Yeah. So I liked how she came right out with the title Death's Door and talked about, you know, the modern dying and the way we grieve. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Sandra Gilbert. Dr. Sandra, are you with us?
I am.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Sandra.
Oh, I'm really honored to be with you.
Okay, so talking about Death's Door, it yes. seems like it has, it's part memoir, it's part like a personal meditation, it's a literary criticism, it's cultural commentary, it has so many different types of genre. Is that kind of accurate?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I can explain that, you know, this was not really an academic book. This was a book that had, it was a partly academic book and a sort of research project, but it had its origins in a very traumatic personal experience of mine. In 1991, my husband of 35 years went in for a routine surgery at the hospital associated with my university, and something must have gone wrong either in the OR or in the recovery room, but we found out later that he bled to death within 6 hours of the surgery. And so within one day, he was dead of the surgery. And wow. It was an incredible shock of what's called unanticipated grief that took me years and years and several books to get over. I had to keep writing and thinking about it.
Yeah.
We brought a lawsuit, and that was very frightening and disturbing. It's something that I think the three of you might understand because of your terrible experience with your mother.
Absolutely.
Having had this crisis and this sudden shock of grief and then having to deal with it in so many different ways. So I wrote this memoir about it called Wrongful Death. And then I wrote a lot of poems. And then I wrote Death's Door to try to think about what my personal experience meant in the context of the world we live in, our culture and our society, which tend to be so death-denying, and in which death and grieving are really often experienced, I have to use this word, as embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I don't know if you had that experience, but
I agree.
As a griever, I found myself, because people didn't know what to say.
Yeah, it puts you...
People don't know what to do.
I remember, because I was actually... when my mother passed, it was a summer in 94, and I was about to start my junior year of high school. And I remember one of the things I was thinking about was going back to school and seeing how people would treat me different. And like you just said, people don't know what to say. They don't know how to act. So it's kind of like this different type of attention than you've ever received. That's all of a sudden thrown on you, and it's something that's you know, it's kind of weird to deal with.
I think it must be very hard when you're in school. I mean, I know that it was hard for my children. They were older than you. They were in their 20s, but it was hard for them. But for me, I felt everything was, in a certain sense, incarnated in me. I was the object of embarrassment and pity, and then I myself felt, well, did I deserve to be embarrassing? Had I done something wrong? Was I guilty in encouraging him to have this really routine surgery that should have gone well? There are so many different kinds of feelings, and then if I feel that I'm embarrassing to other people, it isn't clear to me how I should speak to them.
Right.
So everything gets very difficult, and in the meantime, you as the mourner, you as the one who is bereaved, are in your own shell of shock, and you don't know how to speak out of that or about it for a while, I'm sure.
Was there any, like... what's the term? Like any huge differences that, I mean, obviously when you lost your husband, life just completely changed for you. But can you like articulate anything that just, and maybe any normalcies that became abnormal, or in what ways did it really change your outlook on life and death is what I'm trying to get to.
Well, it changed my outlook on life and death, and I begin Death's Door by talking about this because for the first, I would say for the first 6 months after he died, I really felt as though a door had opened into death, that if he was there in death, I should go there and be with him. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that I was suicidal. I wasn't. It was just that, I don't know how to explain it, it sounds kind of mystical, but it was as though death had become so plausible. I mean, this person who was bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, my beloved husband, was there in death, which you experience as a place. And so, I mean, that's where my title Death's Door comes from. Maybe the door had opened for me too. Maybe I should go through that door, but certainly at least I was looking into it.
Yeah.
Of course I had had other losses in my life. My father died when he was unfortunately too young. My grandparents had died, a beloved aunt had died. A premature baby had died. That was a horrible shock. But they were just taken from me, whereas this was like, this door had opened.
Yeah, and I can relate so much to that because I remember when my mother passed, it was strange. All of a sudden, I had zero fear of dying. I don't want to say I didn't care, because, but I kind of didn't care. Like, whatever happens to me at this point, let it happen. It was the first time I, like you said, I had dogs that died, and even you know, family friends that had passed. So I was always an empathetic kid, so it still hurt me. But when my mother passed, it was like the first time I didn't mind to die, if that made sense. And like you said, I wasn't suicidal. I never found myself being suicidal, but it was the first time I didn't care whether I was alive or not. And so
no, it's a very curious experience.
Yeah.
It's very curious and mysterious. And then it goes with all these other things, like either thinking that you see the dead person or having dreams in which they appear, but then you lose them. Mm. I remember when my father died one time, thinking I saw him walking past my house. I think a lot of people who grieve have that experience. You see someone who looks like the lost person.
Yeah.
And because you really can't believe that the lost person is lost,
yeah,
you think you're seeing them.
Right.
And then, of course, you talk to them in your head. I'm sure you must have talked to your mother.
Oh, yeah.
I know I talked to my father, and I really, really talked to my husband.
Yeah.
And I wrote a lot of poems to him. And the poems were like letters. I felt it really necessary to date them, and you know, just as if I was writing a letter, here I am in New York on this date and I'm writing to you. Somehow feeling that he was going to get them, as if there was some kind of magical email.
Right.
Really weird.
Right.
Dr. Sandra, this is Terrell speaking.
I have
a question.
Hello, Terrell.
How are you? I mean, I think I get a good understanding, but I just want to hear your opinion. Why death is very awkward, and there's a lot of different layers to it. Why is it so hard for us to deal with it in terms of speaking about it, anything that deals with death, wills, funerals, and preparing, talking about with maybe children, if we have children, or other loved ones before it even happens? Because it's one thing that everybody experiences.
Right.
We're all going to go through
well,
it.
Well, I think that that's why what you're doing is so wonderful. We really live in a society that denies death. One sociologist, a man named Zygmunt Bauman, said in our culture, he said something like, it's almost as if death is regarded as a personal fault. You know, we're so into fitness, we're so into healthy eating, we're so into, you know, exercise and positive attitudes, that it seems as though if you die, you know, unless you are killed, but if you die, you must have done something wrong. And if you're killed too, maybe you did something wrong. You walked across the wrong street, or you went to the wrong hospital, you know. So that's why. And then we're a death-denying society because we really don't have any really socially agreed on ways to deal with death. I was at a dinner party the other day where one woman said very cheerfully, well, of course, everybody is cremated nowadays. And I just looked at her. I didn't know what to say because, no, my grandparents were buried in a family plot. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know people who I have friends who are cremated. I had a beloved who was cremated, but my husband is buried, mm-hmm. you know. But she said it so cheerfully and as though it were just nothing and we should just fly over it, not talk about it. So that's something, there's something about our attitude toward death. We get rid of the evidence. We don't want to think about it. When we, instead of having memorial services where we grieve, we have what we call celebrations of the life. All of that is very well. We should celebrate the life, but we also have to mourn the death. I mean, we lost somebody. Yeah. We're in pain. We're suffering. And we really have to go through the pain and go through the suffering. And my personal opinion is that if you don't go through the pain and the suffering, you're not going to, it's always going to be with you.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to really go through it. I don't know whether you three agree with me, but.
Definitely agree.
I'm stopping to ask
your opinion.
Yeah, no. Death is very, very heavy, obviously. And I want to get your thoughts on another thing. We've talked about it often on the show. Hello, can you hear us?
Dr. Sandra, are you there?
Loser.
Oh, dear.
Uh-oh, we hear you, Dr. Sandra.
Is she there?
Yeah, maybe she... Can you hear us, Dr. Sandra? Okay, maybe she'll... I'll hang up so that she can call right back. But I think she makes some good points. One of her points she's already made that I love is how our culture denies death.
And yeah, we almost look at it like a failure.
Yeah, but... And we don't even want to talk about it like it's not part of life. You know?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask her.
Because it's so true. We talk about life, we talk about the stages of life, but when it comes to death, it's like something like we just completely ignore. And I think until that is addressed, mm-hmm. it's always going to be this uphill battle for grievers, you know?
Yeah. It's one of those things that you don't really discuss until you go through it, I think. Mm-hmm. And that, but to me, is too late. You know,
yeah.
We've said it on the show that there should be some type of course or something in the academics where they have that. Shion?
Yeah, yeah. I'm wondering how do we go about changing that as a society?
Because we do need to talk, and we often avoid it because nobody wants to deal with that. It's a
Dr. Sandra.
Difficult. She there?
You there? You with us, Dr. Sandra? She should be here. Hello? Oh, we keep losing you. She's bringing so much knowledge, too.
Yeah. So I just feel it's something, because I remember the first time with death, I remember my my kindergarten teacher passed away.
Yeah.
And I remember Mom explaining that she had passed. And I didn't really know too much about it then, but I just knew that she wasn't coming back and she had passed. And then I didn't really know how to... I was very young at that time, I think maybe 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. Because she didn't pass while I was in the same, while I was learning from her. It was, you know, a couple of years after. But
hello?
Didn't really.
Dr. Sandra, can you hear us?
Hello?
Can you hear us? We can hear you, Dr. Sandra. Huh, I wonder why she.
Hello?
Can you hear us, Dr. Sandra? Yeah, I don't know.
Is it your mic or?
No.
No, she can't hear me either.
Yeah, I don't know. Go ahead, Terrell. Finish the story.
I was just saying, basically, since that, the next time I dealt with someone passing, you know, majorly, was Mom.
Yeah.
And I that was, you know, obviously close to home, and just there's so many things that I went through and I didn't really understand, and so many questions I had. And when you go through something like that, it just, your whole world changes. Just,
like, instantly stops.
Yes,
it, feels like.
It changes.
Yeah,
and you find yourself in a lost position. We for us it was hard because it wasn't. I like the I had never heard the term. She said it was an unanticipated death.
Yeah,
is that how she said it.
Yeah.
But that was us. That was us. It was a sudden death. She was taken away from us, and here we were, three boys without our mother, and not really knowing how to go through this and how to navigate through life. Now, fortunately, we had our family, You know, Uncle Michael was there for us and helped us a lot.
Grandma.
And Grandma as well. I think Pops, obviously he was there for us, but I think he as well
was grieving
and was struggling, just like we were, yeah. You know?
Dr. Sandra, can you hear us now?
I'm here, yes.
Yes.
We somehow got disconnected.
We got you back. Terrell had a question.
Yeah, so my question was that death is so heavy, and it's something we never really talk about until we actually deal with it, until we actually go through it. And we had even mentioned on previous shows that we felt it was something that should be in the schools, a course or something where they can learn about it, because it's something that happens to all of us, and that we, you know, whether it be a friend, it's like TJ was saying, it's an awkward moment. For us, whether we lose someone or someone else loses, there's a weird situation where you don't know how to help someone, or you don't know how to approach, and vice versa. And I think that needs to somehow get eliminated. And I just wanted to know your thoughts.
I think that's very wise of you. I think there ought to be a better way to talk about it. And one of the things is we need to be freed from this sense of social embarrassment and confusion, and as you say, awkwardness. People don't know what to say to us when we are grieving. And I didn't know, before I myself was grieving, what to say to other people.
Yeah.
I was embarrassed and confused. Before I started doing all this writing and thinking about death and grief and mourning. And then I realized that we just have no ways. I mean, you know, in the 19th century, people would put on black veils or something. In Victorian England, or people in some parts of the country still have really serious, you know, religious ways of addressing death, but many of us don't.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't, then we're stuck, because what do we do? What do we say? How do we help if there are no agreed upon ways?
That's
very difficult for everybody everywhere. And yes, indeed, in schools, there should be classes in which we don't necessarily need to have a course just in death and dying, but a course in which you read maybe stories about death, and you read poems of grief, and then you talk about what it means, and you sing songs and hymns about loss and grief, and you help children to think about that, because they do need to.
I
mean, look
agree.
At what must children be thinking in the schools right now, like with the shooting in Florida. Yes,
exactly.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to ask you a question, Dr. Sandra. I know this answer, but I'm going to ask it for our listeners. What are your thoughts on the idea or the desire for closure after death? Is closure a realistic goal when it comes to death?
I really think closure is a strange idea. People do always seek closure, and I've actually heard the word closure most often in relation to let's say the execution of Timothy McVeigh, who was the Oklahoma City bomber, and the people who were related to those who died in that horrible event said that maybe they would get some closure from seeing his execution. Closure there seems to mean something like relief. But closure, I mean, the person who is dead again every day, and you're always mourning them. Of course it gets different, it gets better. You can talk about it more. You have learned to live with it. You have learned to come to terms with it. If that's closure, I guess that's okay. But closure meaning really now it's closed? It's closed off? Mm. It's not closed.
Yeah, I definitely think...
I mean, you know it's not closed.
Absolutely.
That's why you started your wonderful foundation. That's why you do what you do.
We even talk about that. You know, it's for us, it's different. I mean, and I'm sure you can relate to it, but for us, it's different types of grief. You know, when I was young, it was, you know, I didn't have my mom, so I had to drive myself to appointments, you know, and that was like the first sting of it. And now, fast forwarding, you know, 20-something years... It's when I look at my grandkids or my kids, I see that they lost an amazing grandmother, and they'll never know their grandmother. And even if I want to take my wife out for a date, it's like, you know, I can't take my kids to an amazing grandmother where they can get some incredible wisdom and experience with a woman that would love them, you know, and show them how to love. So it just continues, you know, and it's never gonna, like you said, be a closure. So no, I agree
with
you.
It's never gone. And it's, you know, in a certain sense, you have to ask, would you want it to be gone? I mean, in a sense, awful as it is that that person is gone, that person is still part of you.
Yeah.
D.H. Lawrence, when his mother died, the writer D.H. Lawrence, imagined her somehow living behind his eyes and looking at the world through him. Well, it's a kind of a fantastic idea, but a way of redeeming her for himself.
Right.
And yes, I know the sorrow. I have four grandchildren, only one of whom met Grandpa Elliot, his grandma, my husband. He was 4 years old when Grandpa Elliot died, and he misses him. And but the saddest thing is the youngest one. She heard that she had this Grandpa Elliot, and his picture is on the wall in my dining room. And when she was 3 years old, she said, you know, I've been waiting for so long for Grandpa Elliot to come back and see me. When is he going to come, Grandma? Mm. Is that heartbreaking?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you lose. And, of course, in your case, as in mine, it's what was taken from you, too, because the person wasn't dying.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's another thing.
Exactly. It's a different type of grief, and it adds a whole nother layer when they've been taken, as in both of our cases. I have to ask you another question in terms of, now, you've written things prior to death's door, so I'm just going to make it a more generic question. How has writing, and whether it's poetry or whether it's the books, how has that helped you kind of come to peace or some type of peace, or just to help you with your grieving process?
Well, I don't... People have often asked me if doing this writing, and I'll get to specifics in a minute, was therapeutic. And I don't know, maybe it was. I've always denied that it was therapeutic. I felt it was something that I had to do, and I had to do to begin with for him. The first thing I wrote after my husband died was about the lawsuit and about his death from medical negligence, and that was this memoir called Wrongful Death, which was published in 1995. And 4 years after he died. And I felt very strongly that it was, I was testifying in his behalf. I felt very strongly that he would want me to speak for him. I really felt he told me what to do. Well, actually, I'll tell you, after he died, one of my friends from teaching at Princeton University was the great novelist Toni Morrison. And Toni called me the day after Elliot died, and she said, now, Sandra, I know you're going to do all the right grieving things. And I said, because she's such a great wise woman, what are those, Toni? And she said, he'll tell you what they are. So, you know, my hair kind of stood on end.
That's a great
point. But I felt that that was what he did. He did tell me, because I knew the kind of person he was. I knew that he would want a lawsuit. I knew that he would want me to testify in his behalf that some wrong had been done to him. And then I learned that there were many other people who die in this country and in other countries from medical mistakes that are unacknowledged, and that I needed to speak for them too. So I wrote this book called Wrongful Death, which was a really testimonial act. But at the same time, as I think I mentioned before, I was writing poems to my husband that were kind of like letters to him.
Now, the letters that you wrote to your husband, is that what makes up Ghost Volcano?
Yeah, those are all in Ghost Volcano.
Cool. Can you read one?
I'd love to read one. This is one that might interest you and might interest a lot of people who mourn, because it's about the idea that the person you love died and then gets somehow reincarnated and is there in some other body. I mean, you feel crazy when you have that idea, but I've read this poem at poetry readings, and after I read it and say, I know that this may seem crazy to you all, at least four or five people come up to me and say, I had the same experience when my husband or my father died. You see, this is an example of how I did it. This is called November 26, 1992, Thanksgiving at the Sea Ranch. That's where I have a house up the coast in Northern California, contemplating metempsychosis. And metempsychosis means the transmigration of souls or reincarnation. And this is really true. I mean, the story that I tell in the poem is really true. so I'll just read it.
Yes.
You tried coming back as a spider. I was too fast for you. As you climbed my ankle, I swept you off. I ground you to powder under my winter boot. Shall I cherish the Black Widow? I asked, because he is you. You were cunning. You became the young, the darkly masked raccoon that haunts my deck. Each night for weeks, you tiptoed toward the sliding doors, your paws imploring, eyes aglow. Let me in. Let me back in, you hissed, swaying beside the tubbed fuchsia, shadowing the fancy cabbage in its Aztec pot. And you've been creatures of the air and sea, the hawk that sees into my skull, the seal that barks a few yards from the picnic on the shore. Today you chose a different life. Today you're trying to stumble through the tons of dirt that hold you down. You're a little grove of mushrooms rising from the forest floor you loved. Bob saw you in the windbreak. November mushrooms, he said, off-white and probably poisonous. Shall I slice you for the feast? If I eat you, will I die back into your arms? Shall I give thanks for God's wonders because they all are you and you are them? The meadow silent, its dead grasses ignore each other and the evening walkers who trample them. What will you be, I wonder, when the night wind rises? Come back as yourself in your blue parka, your plaid flannel shirt with the missing button. These fields that hum and churn with life are empty. There is nowhere you are not, nowhere you are not, not.
That's awesome. That's great. That's great, Dr. Sandra.
Thank you.
That's great.
Thank you. One thing I was thinking as I was reading this poem is that in many cultures, maybe even in our own, there's always this idea that the dead are trying to come back to us, that they're suffering, that they're in another place, and they're trying to come back somehow.
What would you say?
And that's also...
What would you say from the... It's talking about, like, the Western culture or the Western world... How do we deal with death differently than, you know, some other cultures? And in what ways do you think we can improve?
Well, we deal with it differently because we certainly, in all of Western culture, I would say, we have no agreed upon religious rituals. Some people do have religious cultural rituals. Most don't. Most, like my friend at the dinner party who said, well, everybody just cremated, gets cremated, and that's that. Don't do anything. And if there's nothing to do and nothing to say, then the mourner is left completely alone, and there's no sense of relief, of dealing with the dead, of doing what's right for them, what's right, and what's right for us to help us relate to them and to our loss. We want to do something to honor the memory of the person who's gone. And in doing that, we do something for ourselves because we reinvigorate that memory and we revitalize the person who's gone because we're there talking about her or him, you know?
Now, let me ask you another question. What are your thoughts on, you know, people have a perception that there's stages of grief, shock, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, I think, and... I'm close.
I think it's more all mixed up.
In what way?
I don't know how you experienced it, but for me, the bargaining, the shock. I mean, of course, yes, with the unanticipated death that you experienced and I experienced, there's an initial shock that just will engulf you for quite some time.
Yeah.
But there's also bargaining that goes on in the middle of it somehow.
Right.
Somehow we can turn back. It's like you rerun the movie and turn back the reel and it won't have happened. There must be something you could do. If I hadn't gone to this hospital, let's not go to this hospital. Or if your mother hadn't been where she was, you know.
Right.
We try to think that way. And then there is anger. I think that after a while we do go through a lot, but the anger and the shock and the sorrow and the misery and the embarrassment, I think those all happen at the same time, too.
Do you think guilt is something that everyone goes through when they're dealing with death and grieving?
I would suppose so. I think particularly with unanticipated grief, why didn't I do this? Why did I let him go to that hospital? But even if somebody dies from, you know, a long illness, you might think, well, why wasn't I there that day? Or why didn't I, you know, take him to this hospital sooner? Or why wasn't she diagnosed? You know, there are lots of ways that people think and blame themselves. And then the guilt, of course, feeds right into the embarrassment. Everybody's looking at me and thinking that I'm a bad wife or a bad mother or a bad son because I somehow let this happen. In other cultures, in India, for example, the widow is regarded as inauspicious. There's something about her karma in the most deep sort of Hindu culture. There's something about her karma that actually led to the death of the husband. So after the husband dies, she has to just wear white and sleep on the floor for the rest of her life.
So why do we go there? Why do we go to guilt? Is it because they're no longer here and there's nothing we can do, so we just find reasons to blame ourselves?
I think that's a very smart point. That's very shrewd. They're no longer here and we feel helpless, and we don't like that we feel helpless, so we must be feeling helpless because we're being punished for something we did wrong.
Yeah.
There's a line that I quote in Death's Door, from a poem by Robert Browning that my husband liked a great deal, where this knight is riding through a field and he sees a horrible, miserable, sick horse, and he looks at the horse and he says, "He must be wicked to deserve such pain."
Mm.
So we think, "I must have done something wrong to deserve this pain. What did I do for this to happen? What could I have done to prevent it happening?" It's a natural human thought. We think, you know, in stories about our lives.
Yeah.
And so as we tell ourselves this story, we think, well, I'm part of the story. I should have done something. Of course, that's not true.
Right. So
that's, you have to get over thinking like that.
Yeah.
But
You raise such a good, important point that I think it's 100% right. I think a lot of people, I mean, even in my case, I never thought, what did I do? No, let me take it back. I never thought I was a reason for mom's passing, but I did think, why me? You know, what did I do to deserve it kind of thing? So there's this type of idea that you did something wrong, and I completely agree with that. And I think you're spot on. We have to find a way when we lose a loved one, when we lose someone,
yeah,
to not blame ourselves,
to
understand it's part of life.
Yeah, because you feel singled out.
Yeah.
You feel exposed and vulnerable. I mean, if you were in high school, if you were a kid particularly, you feel weird. Well,
yeah,
this didn't happen to the other kids. Yeah. Why did it happen to me?
Yeah.
And for me, as a relatively young wife, I mean, I was in my 50s. That might not seem that young to you, but now it seems kind of young to me.
I know it's young.
Why everybody else is still married to their husbands or their ex-husbands are still alive, you know. Why am I the one? Why did this happen to me?
Dr. Sander, how do you approach when a friend or someone you know, when they experience a loss, a severe loss of a loved one, what is your role for their grieving process?
I really try to be there with them much more than I would have been before. Before I would have been like the embarrassed, you know, the embarrassed consoler that I know so many people were who came to try to help me, but they were embarrassed. But what I do is I just want to sit with them and give them tea and let them talk and ask them to talk or not talk, whatever they want. I think being with the person is what you have to do.
Just be there.
And letting them feel, you know what I mean? So often people just say something like, "Oh, well, it's a blessing he was suffering so much. It's good it was so fast," or just think it might have been worse, or, you know.
Yeah.
People try to say cheerful things. That's because they're embarrassed, because death itself is not cheerful.
Right.
You have to confront the pain and help them experience it and then get through it.
Yeah. And I think for our listeners, it starts at a young age. I think it's something that I'll admit it's hard to do, but I consciously try to do with my young ones, is talk openly about death and the concept of death, and just be direct with it. Obviously, I don't want to scare them, but at the same time, I want them to understand it's a stage in life, you know, and everyone's going to go through it.
Right.
What, Terrell, did you have?
Yeah. you've written many books, and I was just curious. You've answered some of the questions that I had earlier just by having you on the show. I learned that a lot of these poems that you were written were for helping you grieve. I wanted to know, how long does it usually take for you to do, like, Death's Door? How much research? Because I was looking at the contents. There's a lot of different chapters and topics that you cover. How long does that take, and how heavy is it for you? Does it make it hard, or are there some weeks
that
where
book
it's
was
heavy?
A huge project. That book was a huge project, yeah. And by the time I wrote that book, I had written this memoir I mentioned, Wrongful Death, and I had written the book of poems called Ghost Volcano. So I really was now trying to understand what it meant to be a person who had to testify about death the way I did, and how I was like other people or different from other people, and how I was like people historically in the past, and how different we were now. So it was a huge research project, and I met so many interesting scholars, and I read lots of amazing books, and enormous. I mean, there are so many poets and memoirists now who write magnificently and movingly about death and dying. There's a poet, Donald Hall, who wrote a book called Without, about his wife's death. She was a poet, and she died of leukemia. So this was anticipated grief, and he traced all the stages of her dying in poems that are very, very moving. And it's a very enormously helpful. And there were so many memoirists. There was, of course, Joan Didion's famous book, The Year of Magical Thinking, in which she wrote about how after her husband died, she couldn't bear for a while to throw away his shoes because she thought he might come back and need them. The craziness of death, you know. I remember it being very hard to give away my husband's clothes.
Yeah,
I know some people who just give everything away right away, but it was hard. So trying to understand those kinds of works and to research the impulses and the sociology and the philosophy behind them was a big job for Death's Door.
Now, before you experienced your husband's death, you kind of were doing more academic style writing, like, you know. And I wanted to actually read this quote that I found you had. You said, "I found that I was so changed, so utterly transformed by my husband's death that after doing all the work I did in writing about it and eulogizing him and describing what we went through in order to find out what had happened to him, I cannot go back to doing literary criticism in the way that I once did." So in a way, it kind of changed your life in a career way.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I was really shaken to my core. I felt I couldn't write in a distanced, abstract way. I felt that I had to write personally and memoiristically, and so that's why I talk about Death's Door as being in different genres, because it's not like an ordinary, you know, research project. It begins with a lot of with five chapters that are really about my personal experience, my sense of the door opening, of death becoming plausible, my sense of being haunted, my sense of what it means to be a widow, my efforts to sort of try to get in touch with my husband by writing email to the dead, as I called it, and also my efforts to right wrong, to testify about the wrong that befell him and therefore me. So those are all personal. I had to do that. I couldn't just write a literary critical work anymore. It's true.
Yeah, it makes sense. Taj has a couple of things from social media from listeners.
I've been just listening to the thread or watching the thread, and some of the listeners are asking, because they're kind of wondering, do you think it's like with death, in terms of why people don't talk about it, more of like a either a superstition-ish kind of thing, in terms of they feel like, you know, by talking about it, it might bring
someone.
Yeah, like, you know, like with, I hate to say it, but no, well, with Pops, like, you know, when we're talking to Pops about, you know, just making a, like, everyone should make a will anyway.
Yeah.
But Pops doesn't want to talk about it, and it's because, and I kind of understand that in a way.
It's like you're bringing it, yeah,
I don't want to talk about life insurance either right now, you know? And so do you think that has something to do with it? That's what these, a lot of the listeners were kind of having an
internal debate. I think that's very true. I mean, there's no question that it's very scary. I mean, I think that's the other reason for, there's embarrassment and there's fear. Mm-hmm. There's embarrassment because there's fear, you know, to be too close to the mourner is somehow maybe the mourner is contagious, you know, and it's like the way my granddaughter, when we go through a tunnel or pass a cemetery, she holds her breath. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have little kids, maybe they do those funny things too.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is a kind of superstitious fear.
Yeah.
I think that's very smart. But I mean, in a sense, I guess I'm saying that's one of the things we have to go through, because since everyone is going to have to confront us, everyone is going to have to mourn or be mourned, we need to know how to do it and how not to be afraid of it.
Right. I think a lot of it just has to do with the preparation. I mean, doing a will or getting life insurance, nobody wants to experience death, but preparing for it just makes it that much closer to you, and it's almost a realization that it's not as far away as it once was. As a kid, you don't really have to worry about life insurance and making a will. As you get older, those are things that you have to really consider, and you have family and children. Those are things you have to consider, and it's just one of those things where it smacks you in the face that you have to start preparing, because you're not going to be here as long as you thought you were, you know, when you were a youngster.
Sure. That's true. But in a certain sense, you know, writing a will and you could think about writing a will and doing life, getting life insurance in a different way. They give you some kind of control. I mean, the idea of dying is associated, obviously, with, you know, loss of control. You won't be here. You won't be in charge. But a lot of people who do write wills over and over again and who keep changing their life insurance beneficiaries are people who have this fantasy of, you know, they're going to control even from beyond the grave by doing these things. So it gives them a certain pleasure to talk about the will is the life insurance. You know, that's, you can turn everything around in a sense.
Yeah,
that's true.
Dr. Sandra, I'm kind of curious in terms of, I know that you've read a lot, you know, in terms of prior to your husband's death, was there any literary works that kind of helped you get through it prior? Not, I know you read a lot afterwards, but that you kind of leaned on prior. I mean,
Oh, so much. I mean, Death's Door is, I was looking at it because I knew I was going to be talking to you today, and I see how it's so full of poems that I had been teaching all my life, and that obviously I turned to in my grief. I turned to the writings of D.H. Lawrence and Wallace Stevens and Emily Dickinson and Toni Morrison, and, you know, I mean, Toni Morrison in Beloved writes about haunting, the haunting of being haunted by a dead baby, and having to come to terms with loss and grief in that novel. And all of those were works that I had been teaching and reading. I couldn't have just compiled them all, you know, and read them all as I was working on Death's Door. I had to have that big sort of backlog in my mind, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, and what was your hope for the public to take away from Death's Door, like after they read it?
This is going to sound very, I hope this doesn't sound trivializing, really, not to be embarrassed by death and grief, to be able to be with those who mourn, and to be able to mourn, you know, fully, not to deny or repress, but to go through pain and suffering. And you don't come to the end of it, but in a certain sense, you come out on the other side, having been through it. But if you don't go through it, I think bad things happen to you.
Right.
I don't know. I think you guys must agree with me, because that's why you're doing the wonderful work you do.
I completely agree, Dr. Sandra. So, Dr. Sandra, we have 1 minute left. on this show. And like we like to do with all of our guests, we like to give you, you know, 30 seconds to a minute to just discuss whatever it is you want to talk about. It could be on topic, it could be off topic, but just as a chance for you to get just
any message
out there to our listeners.
Well, my message, as I said, is don't be... We have to be... Of course we're afraid of death and dying, but we have to come to terms with it. We have to confront mortality. When something is painful, we have to suffer through it. We have to learn to speak it and to speak about it. And when you're with someone who is mourning, you really have to be with them and let them mourn. And don't be embarrassed by their pain and suffering. I remember being embarrassed by my own mother's wailing, and I shouldn't have been. You have to just be there with the person and let the person experience that dreadful sorrow precisely so she can get through it and get over it. And I feel quite sure you agree with me.
Completely. Yeah. Well, Dr. Sandra Gilbert, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
To all our listeners, Dr. Sandra's written on many books that are available on Amazon.com, of course. Make sure to check her out. I just want to thank you on behalf of my brothers, Dr. Sandra, for joining us today from Northern California.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
We appreciate it, and I know our listeners do too. So thank you so much, and take care.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I thought it was awesome.
Yeah.
A lot of information, a lot of things stuck, were strong.
Knowledgeable, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the main thing from Dr. Sandra is we can't be embarrassed.
We have to talk about
it. We have to talk about it.
Yep.
Well, that's our show. We have to get going. But we want to thank all of our listeners for listening. We didn't take phone calls today because it's hard for me to navigate a phone call and bring in phone calls, but we want to thank everyone who responded on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Keep spreading the word about DDJF and keep openly talking about grief and anything you're going through. Find your best friend, find that family member, just talk. It's so important to get it out of your system. If it's not the traditional therapy way, then talk to your animal, talk to yourself, go boxing, go running. Do something to get anything that's bothering you out of your system. And it may never completely go away, as my brothers and I can attest, but at least it's helping you navigate through it.
Mm-hmm.
That's our show for today. Anything else, brothers?
You guys want to talk? A happy belated birthday to Tiffany.
Happy belated birthday to Tiffany.
On the 19th.
All right, that's it. You guys have a wonderful rest of your week, and we'll see you next Wednesday at 1 o'clock.
Adios.
Thank you for listening to The Power of Love. We are here to provide hope, resources, and a community so no one feels alone in their grief. Support for our Power of Love radio show comes from a variety of generous donors, including supporters from institutions, individuals, and corporations through the D.D. Jackson Foundation. DDJF is a nonprofit 501c3 organization.